Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over the next 4 years, progressive change at the federal level will be close to impossible. Today's guest, longtime labor activist Steve Early, believes that concerned citizens can harness the power of local politics to reclaim their communities and make local governments a source of much-needed policy reform. He points to Richmond as a successful example. In his new book, Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City, Steve Early chronicles progressive change in Richmond, which is home to Chevron, one of the largest and most powerful corporations in the world. He writes about how successful community organizing raised the local minimum wage, defeated a casino development project, challenged home foreclosures and evictions, and sought fair taxation of big oil. So how can citizens harness the power of local politics to reclaim their communities and change policies at the local level? How did Richmond do it? Steve Early has been an organizer, lawyer, union rep, and labor activist for the past 45 years. He's the author of several books, including Save Our Unions, Dispatches from a Movement in Distress. His latest is Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City. And Steve Early joins me in studio. Hi, Steve. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. Congratulations on your book. I grew up in Petaluma, and so I'm a California native. I found it really interesting. You revealed so many things that I did not know about Richmond. Why did you decide to take on this project? It's really timely, but why tell the story about Richmond?
Well, I moved to Richmond 5 years ago after spending close to 40 winters in New England, so it was definitely time for a change, and was immediately struck by how vibrant and diverse and lively the city's political culture was. About 15 years ago, a coalition of Green Party members, some activists in the Peace and Freedom Party, dissident Democrats, socialists of varying stripes, independents, came together and formed this progressive alliance. And over the last decade and a half, they've succeeded in building, I think, a very unusual model for building a municipal reform movement that's multi-issue, that's multiracial, that's working-class oriented, and that has a lot of intersectionality, to use that popular term, because Richmond really has issues of race and class to deal with, immigration, environmental justice, housing affordability, police accountability, labor standards controversies, most recently a rent control victory that we're now trying to consolidate. So every imaginable local manifestation of a national social and economic problem, you have it in Richmond, and you have people struggling to come up with some creative solutions to make their city safer and cleaner and greener and more equitable.
And it's so interesting to learn about the Richmond Progressive Alliance and just how it formed and what went on behind the scenes, because you've got members of the Green Party, you have Democrats, Peace and Freedom, people who don't or socialists who historically wouldn't really want to work with the Democratic Party, but they came together to work together. And I just think this is so timely right now, as we're seeing so many protests happen on the streets today, at different factions really trying to come together.
Very definitely. And it's not a purely electoral approach. What has strengthened the Richmond Progressive Alliance is being the kind of hybrid organization. There's 300 or 400 individual dues-paying members. There's affiliated organizations, community groups, and unions. There is, every 2 years, a slate of candidates backed by the alliance. But more importantly, there's a year-round program of organizing around community issues. So alliance is able to, I think, a greater degree than in politics generally, hold those folks that it helps elect accountable. And when they get into office as mayor or city council member, there's a much higher expectation that they're going to use their bully pulpits to help mobilize people in the constituencies that they elected. And that's an unusual relationship, but it's one that's really strengthened grassroots movements in the city and made progressive elected officials more effective and more accountable to the people that voted them in.
One of the things that was great about your book is the history the stories you tell about the history of Richmond and how it was transformed from a white majority city to a city with a large black population. A lot of people don't know about the number of industries that were based in Richmond. Give us a thumbnail sketch of the history and its main economic engine.
Well, for over a century, Richmond has been a blue-collar city. It grew up around a rail terminal and a ferry to San Francisco, a deep water port, and what is now a 115-year-old refinery. It was started when Chevron was Standard Oil. And the city that grew up around those industrial facilities in the first half of the 20th century was a predominantly white working class city, very few minorities. And that changed dramatically during the Second World War when Richmond's population exploded. More than 100,000 workers were recruited to work in Henry Kaiser's shipyard, which knocked out hundreds of merchant marine vessels. And Kaiser was a very progressive capitalist. He had a big federal contract. He had to hire workers. There was a wartime labor shortage, and he was forced to hire women and black people. And he recruited African Americans from the Jim Crow South to come to Richmond to, for the first time, break into shipyard work. For women, this meant doing non-traditional jobs. For black workers, this meant breaking the color line and working alongside union members who had previously excluded them from their ranks. So it was a major social engineering experiment. The Kaiser Shipyard had a prepaid medical plan. It had a daycare center. And it really led to the empowerment of the African-American community in Richmond. The NAACP in the post-war period grew out of a black caucus in the Boilermakers Union in the shipyard. And there were many post-war struggles by African-Americans who didn't want to go back to the South, who wanted to make Richmond their own city and had to fight to desegregate housing, desegregate city departments, and to fight for a place in the political life of the city.
You also write that the Richmond Shipyard's Child Development Center became a model for the federal government's Head Start program back in the 1960s.
It did, and the prepaid medical plan and field hospital that Kaiser operated for shipyard workers was the nucleus of what has now become Kaiser Permanente, a multi-state health maintenance organization and hospital chain that serves 10 million people in California and other parts of the country. So Richmond really was the birthplace of a lot of innovation long before the current progressive era of people running for city council and mayor and trying to use city government as a laboratory for public policy initiatives.
And talk a little bit about what you learned about African Americans who came to the area who did not have a good experience. I mean, as you said, you write about a lot of people who left the Jim Crow South. They left Oklahoma, Arkansas, Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi to get jobs in Richmond. But as you write, Lucretia Edwards, a longtime neighborhood leader, recalled, quote, "It was assumed by the pre-war original core community that the shipyard workers would return to the far-flung states and towns from which they had come. This did not happen. The chaos of life in a town with a quadrupled population was compounded by post-war and unemployment. Many of the residents who came as shipyard workers had no feeling of participation in the life of the city."
Shipyard workers, while welcomed during the war, were when the war ended, the city, the white power structure of the city basically said, "Thank you for your service, you know, go home." Mm-hmm. And people didn't go home, they stayed. And they had to fight to desegregate the city workforce, to find decent housing after wartime housing was torn down, basically, to try to drive them out. So many veterans of shipyard work were able to find jobs in other Richmond industries. African Americans over time, 60s and 70s, gained ascendancy politically. But the city in the later decades of the 20th century began to experience many of the problems of Rust Belt cities. Industry began to move out. Downtown began to decay. Racial tensions develop. Drug trafficking became a serious problem. Gun violence, gang activity. And the city suffered from a lack of decent well-paid, blue-collar jobs and became a city known for crime, corruption, and Chevron, polluted, dysfunctional, badly scarred because of a century of heavy industry that left quite an environmental toll, took quite an environmental toll on the people and the landscape.
The title of your book really says it all, Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City. Richmond's history is very much tied to Chevron, one of the biggest oil companies in the world. We'll talk about what happened when you moved to Chevron to Richmond 5 years ago, but what else really struck you in doing the research about Chevron's control of Richmond historically?
Well, it's there's lots of company towns. They take different forms. Coal company town. Some people think of Washington, D.C. as a company town, with the federal government being the dominant employer. We have company towns in Silicon Valley. But Richmond really did fit the traditional mold, with one major employer dominating the economic and social and political life for a century. And even after the workforce of the refinery, for the most part, moved out of town, Richmond Chevron management still pulled strings in City Hall and spent large amounts of money electing big oil-friendly city officials. And that began to change 15 or 20 years ago. People were paying too high a price in terms of pollution and lack of emissions controls and repeated accidents, flarings, and fires and explosions. Downwind neighbors, mainly poor and black, Latino folks in Richmond were suffering high rates of childhood asthma. There were cancer clusters. There were all kinds of well-documented problems, health problems, related to living around the perimeter of a major oil refinery. So there began to be environmental justice groups that challenged Chevron, and then when the Richmond Progressive Alliance emerged, people willing to run for city government on a program of taxing the company, cleaning it up, and strengthening the local, state, and federal regulations governing its operations.
Why was Richmond at that time so neglected and isolated? Because you write also that Chevron and other industries left a trail of toxic chemicals in the soil. There were vacant buildings, high crime, unemployment, the highest rate of AIDS among the African-American community in the Bay Area. Why did this happen? I mean, talk about the different power structures that resulted in this.
I think you can look at Youngstown, Ohio. Excuse me. You can look at Detroit, Michigan. You can look at parts of Cleveland and ask the same question and get the same answer. Once industry moves out and good-paying, unionized, blue-collar jobs leave, people are left in bad shape. Young people start to drop out of school. Families become dysfunctional. People descend into a terrible state of poverty, and drugs, guns, gang activity become a major factor in the deterioration of the quality of life. And Richmond suffered really from all of those problems. And, you know, Chevron ran the place and was mainly concerned that there was a business-friendly cadre of city officials who would give it what it wanted, and the social decay and the economic decline and the chaos around it, you know, was of little concern to the people who had been running the show for 100 years.
Today we're speaking with Steve Early, a lawyer, labor journalist, union rep, and activist. He's been doing those things for the last 45 years, and he's out with a new book called Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you live in Richmond, we'd love to hear from you. Give us some stories. Talk about your experience living there, the changes that you have seen over the years. As Steve writes, Richmond is home to Chevron, one of the largest and most profitable companies in the world. Richmond has suffered from poverty, pollution, poorly funded services, a lot of corruption. But in 2012, when he moved to Richmond, he discovered a city struggling to remake itself. And he chronicles 15 years of community organizing, that resulted in major progressive changes. So what changes have you seen in Richmond? What are your thoughts on the relationship between Chevron and the citizens of Richmond, and then also the political makeup of the city and the changes that you've seen there? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you live in the Bay Area, I remember growing up in Petaluma and driving around the Bay Area with my family and seeing the smoke plumes and just wondering what that was. I mean, we all are affected by what's happening in Richmond, but so many of us don't really know about what goes on behind the scenes and the politics of Richmond. So if you have any questions for Steve, we'd love to hear from you. And then also, he just writes about the power of getting organized locally and how, if successful, you can really see major, major changes. Let's talk a little bit about the politics, because you write extensively about political corruption, mismanagement, which led to so much cynicism and anti-government sentiment in Richmond.
Yeah, I mean, Chevron for a long time ruled as part of an establishment coalition that also included the Chamber of Commerce, understandably, the Manufacturers Association, major developers, conservative building trades unions, and the police and firefighters. They were a formidable force in terms of their campaign spending, their influence in the community. So when the Richmond Progressive Alliance merged as a counterweight to the political establishment, the organizing that it did helped its candidates provide a different vision of what the city could be. And the key element of that was that they would be corporate free. Richmond Progressive Alliance candidates, as Bernie Sanders did when he ran for president, refused all business donations. They have fought for election law reform in Richmond. We have a system of public matching funds that rewards people who don't have big corporate benefactors but can raise small private donations, and the impact of that is magnified with city matching funds. The year-round organizing of the Progressive Alliance has enabled, over the last 12 years, progressives to win 10 out of 16 city council and mayoral elections, which is a one-loss record that's quite astounding. And last month, as a result of two more election victories last fall, there's now a progressive supermajority on the Richmond City Council, 5 out of 7. And the two most recent additions to the council were both very strong proponents of rent control, which was on the ballot as a referendum question on November 8th, and that was adopted by a vote of 2-1. So that measure really was of great importance to many people who are struggling to remain in Richmond. There's a lot of gentrification pressure, a lot of displacement already underway, and as a result of rent control being adopted, rents were rolled back to the level they were a year before, and landlords now have to have just cause before they can evict their tenants. A lot of legal skirmishing going on about the formation of the rent board, but this was a major breakthrough in terms of trying to maintain housing affordability for a very mixed community.
And this Measure L in November, 65% of Richmond voters voted yes to establish rent control and just cause eviction protection.
And it was a 15-year struggle. This was one of the initial objectives of the Richmond Progressive Alliance at a founding meeting in 2004. It took patience and persistence to pursue this goal. Over the 18 months of the home stretch of the campaign, the California Apartment Association spent hundreds of thousands of dollars trying to block this initiative. It was originally passed as a city council ordinance, and the Apartment Association did a petition drive to nullify that, so there had to be a ballot measure last fall to, in effect, reenact it. But I think this is an inspiration to other communities facing similar pressure on their lower-income tenants. It was in Santa Rosa last night, where a similar measure is on the ballot in June, and people are organizing there to also make their community going forward more affordable for all kinds of people.
And the Chronicle had a story about this, and they interviewed Juan Lorenzo, who rents a two-bedroom apartment in Richmond. His rent jumped to $1,335 from $1,000 last year, so a $335 increase. And we have a call, actually, about this, the rent control measure. Let's go to Don in Richmond. Hi, Don. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Yes, I live in Richmond. I have lived here for about 8 years. I've owned a couple of houses in Richmond since 2005. I live in one of them, and the other one I rent out. And I want to offer a little balance to Steve's comments. And Steve, I'll look forward to reading your book. You obviously have done a thorough study of Richmond, and I have a lot to learn about what you know already. My experience is that I struggled through some difficult times in renting my property here. I don't consider myself a wealthy person, and I rely on preserving my capital for my retirement, which I'm enjoying somewhat now. So we had a downturn in the market some years ago, 2008, and I suffered through the period paying a mortgage and paying high, very, very high taxes in Richmond. And finally got to the point where the market started to recover along with the rest of the economy, and gradually got close to something like a break even. And lo and behold, the Richmond Alliance was promoting a rent control ordinance, which, as you point out, is now passed. And as I was trying to recover from the hole that I had found myself in, I was confronted with at least a political environment which people are making me out to be a bad guy because I'm raising my rents. I want to say that it's a goal, which is one of the goals, is to try to create a rental housing, an adequate amount of rental housing in Richmond. Rent control runs flatly counter to that worthy goal, because you disincentivize the people who have the ability to provide that housing from making it available, because they don't have any opportunity to recover a reasonable amount on their investment. What's reasonable? Reasonable is largely in the eye of the beholder. I grant you that. If you're a poor guy and your rent goes from $1,000 a month to $1,300 a month in a month, that's very troublesome. But the other side of the equation is the family may have owned the house for a long period of time, and they may be trying to send the kids to college. Who knows what? There's another side.
Don, let me get a comment from Steve.
Well, I think Don is articulating some of the concerns of opponents of rent regulation, including, excuse me, our current mayor, Tom Butt, who campaigned very forcefully and unsuccessfully against adoption of rent regulation last fall. I think the impact of rent control has been overstated. It, in many ways, it's a stopgap, a necessary stopgap measure, in my view. It's not a panacea. If we had a lot more affordable housing being built, that would be a better solution. But in the meantime, we have 10,000 units occupied by maybe 30 to 40,000 people who are going to now not be subject to huge spikes in their rent, which will force them out of the city. The formula for allowable rent increases is not one that's going to make landlords happy, because the sky was the limit before, and it's not now. The requirement that there be just cause for eviction gives people an element of due process, but opponents have claimed that this is going to be bad for neighborhoods because bad tenants will be impossible to evict. I mean, we're going to have to see. A lot depends on the composition of the executive of the rent board, how people use their new rights, and certainly we're going to learn from the experience of Oakland, Berkeley, San Francisco, other cities that have been doing this with varying degrees of success, depending on your point of view, for the last 30 years. So it's not a totally unknown approach or concept. It only applies to housing, thanks to the state legislature that was built before 1995. You know, there's a lot of people, a lot of landlords that won't be affected by this. But I do understand that, you know, people who are homeowners, had another unit, are not big commercial landlords, are apprehensive about how this is going to affect them personally.
Well, thank you for the call, Don. Today we're talking with Steve Early about his new book, Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City. When Steve moved to Richmond in 2012, he discovered a city struggling to remake itself. And in his new book, he chronicles 15 years of community organizing that has resulted in major progressive changes. And if you have a question or a comment for Steve or a personal story about the changes you've seen in Richmond, we'd love to hear from you. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion, or a question you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may post a comment or question at the show's website, which is yourcallradio.org, or you may tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up in just a half an hour, it's the BBC's World Have Your Say at 11 o'clock here on 91.7 KALW. Time right now is 10:32.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about what is driving U.S. policy in Yemen. The nearly two-year U.S.-backed Saudi military attack on Yemen has killed more than 10,000 people. The January 29th Navy SEALs raid is getting a lot of media attention. It resulted in the deaths of 30 people, including 10 women and children. So what do we need to know about U.S. policies in Yemen under Barack Obama? We did a couple shows about this last year, but it really didn't get that much attention. And then also, what can we expect under Donald Trump? That is tomorrow at 10 o'clock. Friday, it's our media roundtable. If anything stood out for you in the media this week, please email us, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, I'm speaking with Steve Early about his new book, Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City. Steve will be discussing his book tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at Book Passage in Corte Madera, and you can find information at yourcallradio.org. In the new book, Steve chronicles 15 years of successful community organizing in Richmond that resulted in major progressive changes. So how did it happen? And what can we learn about really organizing at the local level? If you have any questions or comments for Steve, or if you'd like to talk about the changes that you've seen in Richmond, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We have an email from Susan who says, I have lived in Richmond for 2.5 years. I was deeply inspired by the Richmond Progressive Alliance when I volunteered and went door-to-door last spring to help pass rent control. I was very proud when it passed. However, my husband is retiring this spring, and we have chosen to move back to Washington State because we're still unable to afford to retire here. Even with rent control now implemented, our housing is just too unstable. The house is unsafe to live in, and we cannot afford to live elsewhere in the area. I will always remember the feeling I got in Richmond that we can change things when we all work together at the grassroots level. I'm very proud of Richmond, the little city that could.
Well, I'm sorry that Susan and her husband are not going to be able to stay. I mean, we need people who are willing to volunteer time and commit themselves to the community. And one of the things that I think I try to emphasize in the book, that that's not always through direct involvement in electoral politics. There's a lot of very good people who participate in city boards and commissions and volunteer programs and non-governmental organizations and the Urban Tilth, Urban Gardens Network, the Bay Trail. There's a high level of volunteer activity that I think helps build a sense of community. And in a city of 110,000, it's 80% non-white, very different kinds of people living in close proximity to each other. But one of the things that binds them together is people's willingness to pitch in and make their immediate neighborhood and the city as a whole better and take real personal pride in that.
Can you talk a little bit more about the coalitions outside of politics that formed? You know, people who maybe have been involved in politics for a long time and understand how the system operates, but also people who've been marginalized and people who felt like their voices actually mattered.
Well, a couple of the affiliated organizations that work closely with the Richmond Progressive Alliance are the Asian Pacific Environmental Network, which operates statewide, but in Richmond has a base among Laotian immigrants and has mobilized them repeatedly for both environmental and economic justice issues. The Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment, ACE, previously known as ACORN, has been a wonderful addition to the community in terms of its capacity to organize among Latinos around rent control, around a number of neighborhood safety issues. We have Communities for Better Environment, which organizes Latinos, Asians, and African Americans adversely affected by refinery emissions. You know, we have some groups that have storefront offices, that have staff people, that have dues-paying members, and their combined efforts, when given necessary electoral expression, have really had an impact on changing the community, whereas in other places they would be functioning perhaps more disconnected, more isolated, more on the margins, and certainly not with the kind of insider access and clout that they've been able to gain by coalescing and working together, not just competing for funding and jockeying for position and focusing only on their single issue or two.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because Richmond is a city of about 110,000 people. So what do you think organizers, activists, people who are getting involved right now for the first time in, say, San Francisco or Oakland or any other larger city can learn from what's happened in Richmond?
Well, it's there's thousands of people around the country, not just in the Bay Area, who, many of them inspired by the Bernie Sanders campaign, are thinking about running for school board, running for county supervisor, running for city councilor, mayor of the state legislature. They're looking for models for doing that. They're looking for training. They're looking for experienced campaign managers. They're looking for ways to finance their campaigns. And so the Richmond Progressive Alliance is trying to find partners with the Berkeley Progressive Alliance, with the Oakland Justice Coalition, with some of the groups I met with last night in Santa Rosa who are behind the rent control campaign. And a number of these local formations are now affiliating with Our Revolution, the national network of progressive groups around the country that was spawned by Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign. And we're hoping that Our Revolution or other multi-state progressive networks like the Working Families Party or the New People's Alliance, you know, will provide the kind of lateral organizing structure that we need to kind of build this movement from the bottom up. And certainly a lot of our focus is going to have to be on local issues because of the deadlock that we face at state level in many states and in the grim circumstances we're going to be looking at for the next 4 years under the Trump administration in Washington.
Steve Early is author of the new book, Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City. Steve is a longtime labor activist and labor journalist. And let's hear next from Bob in North Richmond. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi.
Hi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Pardon, my name is Bob Ellison. I was born here in North Richmond in 1934. And I remember coming up in that wartime milieu in Richmond, and always wondered about it because it was the effect on me when I was still a kid. And my question is that how effective was our Mayor Gail McLaughlin and activist Dr. Clark and Johnny White and a guy named Fred Jackson? How do they play a role in this effect of Richmond becoming a little bit different? Because I remember that after the war in 1948, seemed like Richmond told everybody to get out of town. The center of town became devastated, like an atomic bomb had it, and it's still that way. And had a lot of influence from the New Yorkers who had businesses here, like Macy's and jewelry stores and dry cleaning. It was really fantastic, but it was a cash and carry town, heavily prejudiced. Like my uncle Douglas became one of the first cops here, brother-in-law became one of the first firemen, stuff like that. But again, I'm emphasize that a lot of black people in North Richmond made their money gambling, and people from the East Coast used to fly out here to gamble because it was considered the most honest place in the world to have a dice game. And from that, I guess maybe the casinos grew, but I'd like to have his comment on that, please. Thank you.
All right. Well, Bob, thank you for calling, and thank you for sharing your views of the changes and the different things you've seen in Richmond since you were born there in 1934.
Well, North Richmond has a storied history, and I try to deal with it a little bit in the book. Unfortunately, it remains an unincorporated area that's got a few thousand people who are not formerly part of the city, even though the city surrounds them there. The policing is handled by the county sheriff's department, and as the caller mentioned, there's been a long history of challenges for people in that neighborhood. Henry Clark, who he mentioned, is in the book, a pioneering environmental justice campaigner, started a group in the 1980s called the West County Toxics Coalition, leading African-American public health advocate who was one of the first people in the community to challenge Chevron to take them on over lax refinery safety rule enforcement, poor maintenance practices, and lack of adequate environmental protection for downwind neighbors. So Henry is definitely in the pantheon of Richmond heroes. You know, North Richmond today, I think, would benefit from incorporation into the city. It was, as I point out in the book, where the Black Panthers did their most successful Richmond organizing in the late 60s and 70s. And hopefully the current administration of Mayor Tom Butt, I know this is one of his priorities, is to try to at some point have a vote and persuade the people of North Richmond they'd be better off uniting with their neighbors, coming under the Richmond Police Department and getting more direct access to city services and being able to vote in city elections, which they can't right now.
Well, and speaking of city services, Gilberto just wrote in, can you please talk about how local progressives could address the fiscal challenges of Richmond? Richmond does not have the revenue needed to address some of the bread and butter issues the city faces, much less a progressive agenda.
I think that's a very important reality check. I in the epilogue to the book, throughout being a big promoter of municipal reform efforts and going local in politics and doing what you can through the instrument of City Hall, I mean, we have to acknowledge that in a place like Richmond, control of the local public schools is handled at the county level. We had a public hospital close, a real blow to the community, again, a county decision. The whole issue of property taxation in California, it's a county function. And, you know, we had this thing in 1978, Proposition 13, which has shifted the burden of property taxation from homeowners to homeowners from big commercial property owners. And if Richmond is going to get out of its annual budget deficit, we're going to have tax reform at the statewide level, because Chevron every year, as a result of the Prop 13 changes in how property is assessed and property taxes are paid, saves about $250,000 a year, and locally about $30 million. And that money, you know, could close the budget gap, could fill potholes, it could keep public services going, hire a few more cops and firefighters, could do a lot of things for the city. And that's why it's so important that, you know, we have a broader movement for tax justice, but can only win that fight at the state level, not at the city level.
Yeah,
sure.
I definitely want to do a show about Prop 13 because, as you point out, in 1978, California businesses contributed 44% of all property tax revenue. Homeowner payments produced 56%. Today, the corporation share is 28%, and homeowners are responsible for 72% of the total property tax bill. Because some large commercial property owners are paying deeply discounted taxes on 1975 assessments, everybody else has to pay $9 $1 billion more. And just to, I guess this number is just really important to repeat, Chevron saves $225 million statewide and $30 million locally thanks to Prop 13 tax breaks.
That's not the way it was supposed to work when people were sold on it years ago. But fortunately, there are some groups statewide that are working on reversing this, and people in Richmond, I think, are very much a part of that movement. They have intervened several times in assessment cases at the county level. They've tried to impose locally. Progressives have utility and manufacturing taxes on Chevron. Chevron does not want to pay its fair share of the taxes in Richmond or anywhere else in the world that it operates, as far as I know. There's major disputes in Australia right now with the company. It has a huge liquid natural gas operation there. And the Australian Parliament just convened a special inquiry into Chevron's tax evasion down under. So it's a global problem with this particular company.
Well, and we haven't even talked about the 2012 horrible refinery fire at Chevron. 15,000 people went to the emergency room. They had respiratory complaints, health-related issues. $1.6 billion was the economic impact. That was the drop in assessed property values, reducing the city's tax base. Here we are in 2017, 5 years later. Has Richmond recovered from that disaster?
Well, the fire in the summer of 2012 did lead the city to sue the company for damages, and that is litigation that's still pending, as they say, and a long way from going to trial. Chevron is very skilled at dragging out environmental litigation for years, decades, if it can, and that has been the history of a major case that many of your listeners are probably familiar with, involving Ecuadorian peasant farmers in the rainforest that was despoiled by a Chevron predecessor. Chevron has been fighting that lawsuit for over 15 years. So I think that's what Richmond has to look forward to in terms of recovering money damages for the adverse economic impact of the 2012 fire. On a more positive note, the state has hopefully gotten very close to strengthening refinery safety rules. Again, 4.5-5-year rulemaking process. Chevron is still appealing the $1 million Cal OSHA fine that was imposed in the wake of that fire. The U.S. Chemical Safety Board, which has no enforcement teeth, really, made some very important recommendations about how the maintenance practices at Chevron Richmond could be improved. One of the important safeguards, really, of workplace safety and community health is an activist union there. And I'm happy to report in the book that United Steelworkers Local 5 has been more active in recent years in blue-green alliances, which bring labor and community together to try to make the company more accountable and the refinery safer, both for its employees and its neighbors.
Well, thank you again for emailing Gilberto. Let's go to our next caller, Bob in Richmond. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you very much, and thank you to the author that you're talking with there. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're fine. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm an attorney, and I'm not retired yet, but I'll probably retire in about 3 or 4 years. And I specialize actually in agency law, administrative regulatory law, but I have a strong interest in adolescents and kids and youth. I used to be a special ed teacher before I was a lawyer. And I just wondered, are there programs in Richmond where somebody with a legal background could be of some use to, you know, the population of teenagers and young adults who I think have often very misguided ideas about what they're allowed, what their legal rights are, what it's like to get involved in the criminal justice system, and I have a fairly weathered view of that, and I think it'd be interesting to somehow put those skills to use in, you know, working with kids again.
There's a wonderful youth program in Richmond called RYSE, R-Y-S-E is the acronym, and I highly recommend volunteering with them. Wonderful center for youth activities of all kinds. This was the group that sponsored the famous and now controversial, still controversial, Black Lives Matter vigil on the McDonald Avenue, the main street of the city, in late 2014. The one that our then police chief, Chris Magnus, joined, held a Black Lives Matter sign, probably one of the only times in the history of our country that a local police chief has joined a protest of that sort, showing solidarity with people in the community concerned about policing problems in other parts of the country. But the Rise Center youth met with the former Attorney General when she came to Richmond a year or two ago as part of the Obama administration's effort to learn from the success of Richmond's community policing experiment. It's a great place to work with young people, and I think they would certainly benefit from the caller's offer of sharing his expertise in terms of how to deal with the law and knowing your rights, and I'd recommend volunteering there.
Can you also talk about the Office of Neighborhood Safety? This was an experimental public-private partnership, and the effort there was to roll back street violence and target young people who were most likely to be involved in violence or, in some cases, even be killed. And we've been wanting to do a show about this for a couple years now. We keep trying to get the young people on the show, and I want to add that back to my list because last time it fell through. But it's an amazing program and very successful,
and one that a number of other cities are trying to emulate with initiatives of their own. The Office of Neighborhood Safety has a small staff of folks who mainly are former gang members. Some are formerly incarcerated, have street credibility, know kids in the neighborhood or getting into trouble, and tries to enlist them in what's called the Peacemaker Fellowship. Some headlines have described that as paying young people to not shoot each other. It's actually a little more complicated than that. People have to make a real pledge to kind of turn their life around, to accept job training and counseling. The stipends are modest, about $1,000 a month for a 9-month period. But the idea is to use mentors who've been through the criminal justice system, learn from the mistakes in their own life, to turn younger people away from a similar personally disastrous path. And the success rate of the Office of Neighborhood Safety is pretty high in terms of people moving away from being involved with guns, drug trafficking, and gang activity, which is a pipeline to a long prison sentence in many cases. So the police department reforms and this civilian-focused effort in City Hall have been complementary and I think are being copied in many other cities.
We don't have much time left, but I want to also talk to you about money in politics and how big money has affected Richmond. The story that you tell about the soda tax that came up in... What year was this?
2012.
Thank you, 2012. I mean, it's just incredible to see how the Beverage Association responded and how many millions they spent in Richmond. And then, I mean, they got vote no on end lawn signs in Black and Latino neighborhoods. It's just incredible to read about what happened behind the scenes here.
In the last three election cycles, if you total up the... Expenditures of big oil, of big soda in 2012, and last fall, real estate interest, the Apartment Association, over $7 million has been spent on local races, the business interests trying to elect business-friendly candidates, and smear and defeat progressive candidates. Richmond politics really is a case study in what has been unleashed by the Supreme Court Citizens United decision, because the state's legal limits on individual contributions are really just meaningless at this point when corporations can spend hundreds of thousands of dollars through so-called independent expenditure committees on negative advertising to promote the candidacies of candidates who have no base in the city. And to defeat referendum measures, in the case of the soda tax, which actually had a pretty good basis in public health policy, but have since been adopted by Berkeley and Oakland and San Francisco and even in Philadelphia. But it proved to be a very divisive race issue in Richmond. The American Beverage Association depicted it as a regressive tax on poor and working class people. And both progressive candidates in 2012 who were associated with the soda tax lost. So I think people learned that if you're going to put something on a ballot, it better produce some immediate economic benefit, like rent control. Otherwise, you know, the big money that's spent against you will take you down.
Right, and as you report, the combined Richmond election spending on Big Soda and Big Oil totaled about $3.7 million in 2012.
Just that one year.
Just that one year.
Yeah. And this is an electorate of 30,000 to 40,000 people, so the per-voter expenditure is huge, as Bernie would say.
Well, and Bernie wrote your intro. What are your thoughts, Steve, when you look at where we're at right now? I mean, you also write in your book about Big Oil giving money to Democrats in Sacramento and as a result killing climate change legislation. I mean, this is a democratically controlled state. In so many cities, Democrats are in control. And yet, look at all the problems we're facing. Massive poverty. We just did a show about that last week. We got so many calls from older people on SSI. Mm-hmm. We see the problems in Richmond. So, I mean, yes, there's problems at the federal level, but we've got problems of our own at the local and state levels. Based on the reporting that you did, what do you think is most effective in tackling these issues?
Well, I think I already mentioned an important reform, and that is local public matching funds. And this has been a hard program for Richmond to sustain, given its annual budgetary stress. But where local public matching funds have been introduced in New York City, there's a limited program of this sort statewide in Vermont, it really has been a boon to progressive candidates, and it has made it possible for people to take the pledge, no corporate donations, and to focus on building a small donor base like Bernie Sanders did for his Democratic presidential primary campaign, and being rewarded for doing that doesn't level the playing field entirely or even come close. But I think it's an important reform that more municipal reform movements need to pursue, and at the state level as well, and eventually at the federal level. I mean, we need to overturn Citizens United, but that's not going to happen anytime soon, unfortunately.
Steve Early is the author of Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City. Steve is a longtime labor activist and labor journalist. He'll be discussing his book tomorrow at 7 o'clock at the Book Passage in Corte Madera. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Steve, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for your phone calls and emails. It was great to hear from so many people in Richmond today. Coming up on the show tomorrow, we will talk about what is driving U.S. policy in Yemen. The nearly two-year U.S.-backed Saudi military attack on Yemen has killed more than 10,000 people. So what do we need to know about U.S. policies in Yemen under Barack Obama? And what can we expect under Donald Trump? That's tomorrow. And if you're free tonight, I'll be discussing feminism and the current state of affairs with Joe Kreider, choreographer for Flyaway Productions, 6:30 at the Joe Good Annex, 401 Alabama Street. You can find information at flyawayproductions.com. Your Call is produced here at KALW. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Helena Murphy is assistant producer, and Stephanie Purcell is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can visit yourcallradio.org. And you can email us, feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. Thanks for joining us.